Blog Talk Radio.
It's the Morning Show.
Okay, you want to rehearse it one time before we go in there?
With award-winning journalist Cheryl Smith.
I'm good. I'm not that good.
Bringing you informative, enlightening, thought-provoking, inspiring, and entertaining talk radio.
What the Supreme Court did the Supreme Court did agree and sided with the suit, and so it became law that the higher education institutions, including UT Austin, did need to desegregate. And so about 5 days after that, Chase was standing in line to enroll, and did enroll on June 7, 1950. Now, the University of Texas at Austin became the first major public institution in the South to open its doors to Black graduate students. See, at that point, we're still talking about graduate students, the law school, architecture. It was on later down in the 50s before undergraduate Black students were admitted. I think it was something like 56, 57, somewhere in there. But we're still talking about the graduate level students at that point. So it became national news, news organizations from the East Coast and what have you came down and covered the story, and took photographs of Chase. There are a lot of photographs in line of Chase in line, enrolling there in the gym at UT Austin, which was where enrollment took place. But then he got a lot of backlash from segregationists and what have you. But Chase wasn't moved by all of that. You know, like I said, he wasn't in this for that, even though he later on took on that role. But he just kind of sucked it up and, you know, got all these nasty letters and phone calls and what all else ways of communication they had at the time. But he just kept looking forward. Now, there were, I know, at least one other African-American student who stood in line there to enroll after him. That student's name was Horace Lincoln Keith. And again, he enrolled in the graduate school. And so, but now African-Americans were not allowed to live on campus. Now, I know a little bit about that, maybe more than a little, because I am an alumni of UT Austin. I was there in the 60s. And even when I enrolled, the dormitories were not yet integrated. Now, my cohorts and I, we had a wonderful time in what was called a co-op house. And then while we were there, the dormitories did integrate in 65. And some of my co-African-American students did move to the dormitory. I stayed at the co-op house. It was called Whitest. Don't ask me about the odd coincidence of that. W-H-I-T-I-S, Whitest Co-op house. And it was integrated. It was integrated right there near Guadalupe Street, which was a major street in Austin, very like a block or so away. And the integrated residents of the house, we got along famously, had a wonderful time, and I have no complaints, very positive experience about it. But at any rate, when myself and other African Americans arrived in the 60s, now again, undergraduate students began arriving in the late 50s, around 56, 57. So at any rate, we're back to John Chase. So wherever Chase would go on campus there in the 1950, he was shadowed by federal marshals because, again, the NAACP was involved. The Supreme Court had ordered that he be admitted and all that. So he was shadowed, sort of like Ruby Bridges in the stories that we read about her and her education integration efforts. This was a triumph for him. And so then he, as I said, he went on to graduate from from UT School of Architecture. And then the other, another student, I don't think we've called his name, Oscar Thompson, in that same year, became the first black student to graduate in some sort of a health area. He graduated and received a health degree. All of this was trailblazing time at the time. And then after graduation, Chase had a problem getting hired. I mean, he applied at a lot of major architectural firms. Nobody would hire him. He was African American. So he was offered a position as an assistant professor at Texas Southern in Houston. So Chase and his wife, her name was Drucie, Drucie. They moved to Houston, and Chase had a talk with himself, and he was still being denied employment wherever he applied, even though he started as a teaching professor, as an assistant professor at Texas Southern. But he said, you know what, I still have this passion for architecture. So he started his own business and went around. He really wanted to, I was interested in designing African-American worship places, churches. So he and his wife just continuous routine, visit churches, let him know about himself, let him know what his abilities were and what his background was and what he wanted to do. And gradually he began to get noticed by black churches in Houston. And he had his own architectural firm. He had business out the door, you know, people wanting him to do business with them. And so it was on. And he started hiring younger black architects and what have you. And that became a feather in his cap. And his style was, he was greatly influenced by a well-known Anglo architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. So his Chase's style was very minimalist, bright, a lot of windows and what have you. That was his style, and it became very popular. And so he built a lot of churches and union halls. in the Houston area and also in Austin and in the Gulf Coast, Texas Gulf Coast. And he's one of the, his well-known businesses was Riverside National Bank in the late 60s, in, well, in 63, which is now known as Unity Bank, which was the first Black-owned bank in Texas. And he designed that building. And then at Texas Southern, oh, he had a number of buildings that he designed at Texas Southern, the Martin Luther King Humanities Center, the Ernest Sterling's Student Center, the Thurgood Marshall School of Law building at Texas Southern. So he became a power broker. And then he really did get involved in the political world. And Houston mayor back then at the time, his name was Fred Hoffhines, had this to say about John Chase. This is a quote from former mayor Fred Hoffhines in the 1970s. He said, "There was never a significant political event happening where John Chase was not in the forefront. He was the head of a group of African Americans who even supported Fred Hoffhines and got him elected." So he had to pay homage to John S. Chase. So and then he was involved in a lot of large public projects. His firm was part of the team that designed the John R. Brown Convention Center there in the Houston area and renovated the Astrodome there. And his firm was awarded the commission to design the U.S. Embassy in Tunisia. So Chase was I want to call him a reluctant trailblazer or a reluctant civil rights warrior, because he just wanted to be an architect. He had been drawing and scribbling since around preschool, five to 7 years old. And it was just in him, and he just pursued it with a passion. And while he was pursuing it, you know, they say, reach back and bring someone with you. He did that by him opening doors and moving forward. African-American aspiring architects followed his footprints, and he gave them positions in his firm after he had to open his own firm because no white company would hire him. And then he began to hire younger other African-American architects and became a mentor and a role model and all of like that. Now, when he became president of the Students Association, the Texas Exes, and also the Students Association, there were thousands of students under him. And so his three children, he had three children, two sons and a daughter, and they all became lawyers. They all became lawyers. So his son, Tony, his sons were John Jr., Tony, and Sandria. The two sons and the daughter. And so his son, Tony, became CEO of Chase Source LP and Chase Radio Partners in 2012. And then the bio on about Chase. Now, let me say that Chase died in 2012. Barack Obama was president when Chase died. And interestingly enough, John Chase's son, Tony, had been a classmate and friend of former President Barack Obama when they were at Harvard. They were classmates. So when Chase's son, Tony, became a big leader there in the Houston area, President, former President Barack Obama, who was there at the time in 2012. It was a lot of political activity going on, and Chase's son Tony was at the helm of it all, and Barack Obama came to you know, some of those things, and Tony Chase gave a big fundraiser at his home for former President Barack Obama. And so John Chase became an ancestor in 2012, and we kind of wanted to remember his name, but again, we want to put him in context with Heman Sweat, who through the NAACP filed the Sweat versus Painter lawsuit that forced UT Austin and just about all of the major universities in Texas. That NAACP lawsuit, Sweat versus Painter, forced the issue, and the Supreme Court did grant the petition of their suit. And like 5 days after that the Supreme Court ruling came down, John Chase was standing in line to enroll in 1950 at the UT Austin Architectural School. Now, just a little bit to wrap up about Heman Sweat. He went through a lot. Heman Sweat went through a lot of tough times as main plaintiff of that suit. Of course, goes without saying, he got a lot of hate mail, just as Chase did. But he also suffered physical disabilities, a lot of stress, ulcers, and what have you. But he did also ultimately enroll in the law school, but it had been a tough, long, grueling fight. He was even advised by, here's another well-known name, W.J. Durham was one of his advisors at that time, along with the well-known name Thurgood Marshall. Sweat, he even worked at the time he wrote a column for the Houston Informer, the black-owned Houston Informer. He wrote a column for then, and the well-known name in black media, black newspapers, Carter Wesley, a well-known black newspaper founder, gave him that opportunity to write a column while he was going through all of this stuff. And so he did ultimately earn a master's degree, and then he moved to Cleveland. And we talk about Heman Sweat. He moved to Cleveland, and he became a leading official with the Urban League and he was going back and forth between Cleveland and Atlanta, and I believe it was in Atlanta when Heman Sweat became assistant director of the Urban League there. And he was with them for well over 20 years and spearheaded a lot of diversity projects for them and projects pushing integration and desegregation. He also taught classes at Atlanta University. And so Heman Sweat, John Chase, and William Sidney Pittman. We want to remember those names. Oh, and I did want to tell you a little bit more about Pittman. Now, like I say, we've talked about him a lot, but his parents were former enslaved Africans. Now, get this, William Sidney Pittman was born in 1875 and died in 1958. But growing up, his architectural interest began because he assisted his uncle who was a carpenter. And so, and again, let me say one reason why Pittman's name is important to us in Dallas, because the Pythian Temple and the Knights of Pythias were very much blessed by the talents of Pittman, because Pittman designed the Pittman Temple, which is the building still stands. It is now a very respected hotel, Pittman Hotel, in the downtown Dallas area. And Pittman's signature, his signature designs and all of that are throughout that very historic building, who has a long up and down history in Dallas, but it's thriving mightily right now as the Pittman Hotel, upscale hotel. But anyway, Pittman was inspired as a kid, helping his uncle who was a carpenter, and then he went on to Tuskegee Institute. And he studied at Drexel Institute, which is now Drexel University, which is in Philadelphia. Then he graduated, William Sidney Pittman graduated from those institutions in 1900. But originally got his college education at Tuskegee Institute, when we know Booker T. Washington was a lead person there. And Pittman was under Booker T. Washington. And so he would travel, but he'd come back to Tuskegee. And at one point when he returned, he headed Tuskegee's architectural school at one time, and he was an assistant professor. Then he moved to Washington, D.C., and he became the first African-American architect to open his own office. Now, here's an interesting part that we always have to get in about William Sidney Pittman. He was married to Booker T. Washington's daughter, who we know as Portia Washington Pittman. Now, the interesting thing about William Sidney Pittman and Portia Washington Pittman, they lived in Dallas for a while. She was very much into music, and she had some music positions in Dallas. Dallas, right here in Dallas, Texas, the daughter of Booker T. Washington. Portia Washington Pittman married to William Sidney Pittman. And, oh, my gosh, there's all kind of research about the buildings that William Sidney Pittman designed. Many of them were churches, but not just churches. And Chase really leaned toward houses of worship, but William Sidney Pittman, you know, did a lot of designs on all kinds of buildings. And there's recorded research about buildings across the nation, not just in Texas, but across the nation, where he designed buildings. Greater El Bethel Church in over there near A Street and 10th Street, and Yvonne Ewell School, Townview School, Greater El Bethel Church. Now, there's been some difference of opinion about whether Pittman did design that building, but the elders who go way, way back passed down oral histories and a few documents that seem to support that Grady L. Bethel building over there was built by Pittman. Now, it just received a historical marker, about a couple of weeks ago, maybe? And the marker does mention William Sidney Pittman, so there's the research had to have been pretty solid once they put that historical marker there. So that Greater El Bethel marker does credit William Sidney Pittman with designing that building, even though there's still some discussion about it. But we're gonna go with what the researchers say. Now, one of the other unfortunate facts, I guess, about Tidman is that he was known as being very eccentric, and he bumped heads with a lot of folks. For one thing, he could not abide this thing called discrimination. William Sidney Tidman was not up for it. He just was very angry and combative and a fighter. He just was not willing to step aside for Anglos who wanted to make him take a back seat because his heritage was out of Africa. So he was a fighter, and he didn't get along with a lot of people. But he was brilliant as an architect, this man. And that was the other thing. You know, when you know you got it going on, when you know you're talented, when you know you've got the skill, and you know, you're not ready to take a back seat to somebody telling you go away. You're not, and who their works, I have no doubt, were not as superior as Tidman's work, but people who were not acknowledging him. So he was angry. And he did develop some social problems. I think I need to go back and be sure about this, but I think I'm pretty clear that he had a little drinking problem. And now he's also known here in the Dallas area by a publication, a very historic African-American publication called Brotherhood Eye. And, oh, my gosh. The people he would bump heads with, and he bumped heads with a lot of the local black ministers in Dallas, he would write about them in this Brotherhood Eye, and it was very controversial. And, oh, gosh, it made a lot of people very angry when they see their name in the Brotherhood Eye. Oh, my gosh. So that was Tidman's life, bumping heads with folk, arguing with folk, being eccentric, developing, you know, social problems like a little bit of a alcohol problem. But again, through all of this, he was doing all this brilliant architectural work. And he, like I said, I mentioned he traveled, you know, around the United States, Washington, and, you know, different other cities and what have you. And so finally, the marriage did not last because he was such a hard to get along with person. The marriage did not last, and people stopped hiring him. They stopped hiring him, and he kind of went back to working as a skilled carpenter, and so finally he in his final days he had no money, no powerful connections, and when he died, William Sidney Tidman died a pauper and was buried in a pauper's grave. It's there in South Dallas off of Elsie Faye Hagen's in a cemetery there in South Dallas off of Elsie Faye Hagen's, which used to be Hatcher Street. His grave is there. But now since then, all kind of acknowledgement, I guess, came to him after his death, and architectural organizations talk about him continuously, and they've had all kind of conventions and symposiums and workshops and what have you that talk about all of his work and his achievements and his life. And his grave has been, a stone has been placed at his grave. And I think there are a couple of streets and developments that are named for him. And so, you know, what is it? What do you do after you've lived your life and you've ended up the way he did? What do you do? Just hope that the next generation will remember you. Hope that they will remember you and that all of your efforts were not in vain. And, you know, African-Americans have buried a lot of skilled and talented people. And I guess, to be fair, I should say not just African-Americans, but, you know, we have to preserve our own history. But we've buried a lot of talent, you know, that has gone unnoted. But we're just glad that the name William Sidney Pittman, the name Heman Sweat, and the name John S. Chase, we're going to try to do what we can to keep those names memorable. While we get prepared for our guest, who's going to join us a little bit after the noon hour, we're just going to talk about a few little things going on here locally. I mentioned to you, I think it was last week or so, that I was just so delighted about the Dallas Metroplex Musicians Association that had their sacred choral music workshop this past weekend. And it was in the Oak Cliff area near, it was on University Hills, which is where Evergreen Mortuary and Funeral Home is located. But the church is called Pearly Gates Baptist Church, where this where the workshop was. So it was a workshop and a concert. But the thing that I really want to point out is that during that concert, and I hope a number of you were fortunate enough to attend it, because it's some great music that goes on at the Dallas Metroplex Musicians Association. And they are a group of pretty much choir members, church choir members and musicians who just don't want to stop being musicians, and they come together and do what musicians do. But at any rate, they renamed this sacred choral music workshop and concert in honor of the organization's founder, who is William S. Mitchell. Oh my gosh, a dynamic Dallas area musician, dynamic, and he founded this Dallas Metroplex Musicians Association. And so during this, because of the pandemic, they had renamed it, the organization, back in 2019, but because of the pandemic and them not be able to hold their events and workshops and what have you, they had the renaming ceremony at this concert that was this past weekend. And so I just wanted to bring that back to your attention, and I want to have you. And then they bring in professional clinicians when they have their workshop and concert every year. And so they did that. They had the first in-person event following COVID this past weekend. And as I said, at that event, they renamed it in William S. Mitchell's honor. So keep that group, keep their name in your mind. Keep that name in your mind. Now, I always like to talk about health and jobs, and I just wanted to remind you again, as I did last week, and I may not mention it again, but at least a couple of briefs I wanted to mention, that Watermark Church there, which is now in the old Pearl C. Anderson School on Garden Lane, in South Dallas near Elsie Faye Hagen's and Cullum, right there on Garden Lane. They have what they call a walk-up urgent care clinic. It's a mobile clinic. It's a mobile clinic and a walk-up urgent care mobile clinic. And on Mondays through Wednesdays from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., you can just walk up and get health exams and needs met there. Now, here's what's so wonderful about it. You don't need it. You don't need insurance. You don't have to have income. You don't have to have an ID. You don't have to have an appointment. You don't have to be from a certain zip code area. Now, if you are so able to contribute $10, you're encouraged to do that, but it's not a requirement. And so here's a lot of the things that they will treat. And I'm talking about the Watermark Urgent Care Mobile Clinic. It's a walk-up clinic. Here's what they can treat: coughs, colds, sore throats, fevers, ear aches, asthma, infections, minor traumas, lacerations, rashes, and ear infections. Now, they will also refer you or give you information about sports physicals and lab work and even pregnancy tests. They can give you information about that. So I just wanted to remind you about that service that is available. Now, here's their website, www.watermarkurgentcare.com. All of that run together, as you know, www.watermark, and Mark is M-A-R-K, Watermark Urgent. Urgent is U-R-G-E-N-T. Care, watermarkurgentcare.com. That's the website. Now, here's the phone number if you've got your pen, because I want you to take care of your health. If you don't have any money or insurance and all that, I want you to be able to go and get some kind of service. Okay, here's the phone number, 214-613-1622. 214-613-1622. And we want to thank Ken Smith, who's the head of Revitalize South Dallas, who helped put out the coalition, Revitalize South Dallas Coalition, and he puts out a lot of this information about services that are available there in that South Dallas area. So we want to give a shout out to him, Ken Smith, for disseminating this information. So one other thing we wanted to note that he tells us about is the South Dallas Employment Project that helps individuals who are seeking training, who are seeking actual job leads, and who are seeking support in their efforts to find a job. So it's called the South Dallas Employment Project, and they have a website. And again, it's www.southdallasemploymentproject.org. All of that together, no spaces, www.southdallasemploymentproject.org. So they'll give you some of the areas that they can tell you about job opportunities, or if you want to be a paramedic or an EMT, a landscaper, a security officer, an office manager, someone working in customer service if you want to be a truck driver. They can give you information and job opportunities for all of that. Now, they also offer training in digital imaging certification, in low voltage work, in Google and CompTIA certification, in solar tech, if you want to be a technician with solar energy, those types of areas. So I urge you to get in contact with them. Now, over at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters, boy, I tell you, Curtis King, the founder of that group, he just does not stop. He doesn't stop. Now, he just got through sponsoring and hosting the this past weekend, it went through Friday, Saturday, and some other days, but at any rate, I think the last the last two performances were Saturday, I believe, but it was Friday and Saturday. More than 400 teens. Wait a minute now. What did I just do? Let's see. Did I do so? Okay, there I am. Y'all don't let me mess up anything. Okay. Ages 10 to 18, there were about 400 youth who put on this musical. It was the 38th Annual Summer Youth Arts Institute. Now, they had been rehearsing and learning and being instructed throughout the summer, and then they gave this big performance, these 400 youth from Dallas schools and what have you. They put on this performance, but it was it was a musical tribute to our own Erykah Badu. Y'all, I went and I just really enjoyed it. I mean, those young people just did their thing. Very energetic, very musical, very talented. They were everywhere in the aisles, on the stage. In the back, they just enveloped the auditorium with all of this music and dance and wonderful stage production. So what they learned throughout the summer was how to manage all this stuff, how to do costume design, makeup, lighting, stage management, photography, film and video, and they put all of that together and put this production on. So it was wonderful, and it was a tribute to our own Erykah Badu. Now, the previous year they did a tribute to Beyonce, and that was fantastic as well. But now I'm trying to get to what's coming up, and so on July 16th there will be a reunion gala of former Summer Institute alumni members. And they're calling it a reunion gala. And it will be at the Dallas Convention Center Ballroom. And it's a gala dinner and dance. Of course, it's a fundraiser for T-Ball, the Black Academy of Arts and Letters. And if there's anything that deserves a fundraiser because of its good works, its valuable existence, it's T-Ball. And so we want you to pay attention to this upcoming, and it's called Giving Back Summer Arts Institute Alumni Reunion Gala. Giving Back. Summer Arts Institute Alumni Reunion Gala. And the alumni are going to be out in full force. And they're going to be dressed down, you know, because it's a dinner and dance and a reception and a meet and greet. Oh, they're going to have a good time. Dinner and dancing and meeting and greeting is at the Dallas Convention Center Ballroom. And again, that's on Saturday, July 16th. And so what's good about this is, again, it's you get a benefit and then you reach back and help give that benefit back to someone who's coming behind you. Now, we just talked about the young folk who did their summary musical honoring Erykah Badu that was this past weekend. Now, so previous attendees for the Institute are now coming together to raise funds for T-Ball to make sure that that institution will be able to carry on its work forward. And so we're going to look forward to that. I do believe that our guest has arrived, and I'm going to bring him in just a little bit. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about him. Let me go ahead, see if I can bring him in and say, let's see, Roger Barkin, are you there? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, so seems like we're on board. Well, I brought you in, but let me just, before we start talking, but let me first say hello. I don't know if it's, is it, yeah, we're still morning. We're still in the morning, a few minutes in the morning, be short of noon. But let me tell the guests a little bit about you. Y'all, this is Roger Barkin, and he is a multi-talented musician who has worked in a number of areas of music, a variety of music genres, blues, jazz, gospel, funk, R&B, you name the genre, he's played it. And he also is very talented on various instruments, musical instruments. I think he started out as a kid on the guitar. He's going to tell us about all of this. On guitar, and then made his way on up. But he taught for a number of years at the Booker T. Washington Arts Institute in the area of music. He had a radio show on KKDA for a number of years back in the day. He has his own recording label. He even does, is my understanding is he does still teach some kind of form or fashion with the online class, but he'll tell us more about that. But he's why I twisted his arm to come on to talk to us today, because guess what? We know a very little about this talent that he has and that he's been using for a number of years. I guess maybe I've been asleep as Rip Van Winkle or something, but he writes books and has written several books and a number of musical teaching instruments, I guess, for lack of a better term. So he's written a number of musical teaching instruments. He writes books, has done novels, and he's going to talk to. So that's why I wanted him to come on today, so I'm going to shut up and let him say good morning. And then I'm going to ask you a question to get us started, but tell us good morning.
Good morning,
Good to have you. So let's just jump right in to that aspect of your life that I talked about, that we know a little bit about. I want to know how in the world, there you were, you're already a musician, you're already playing all these instruments, you're already performing everywhere, not only around Dallas, but everywhere else. How did you get involved with writing? Does that go way back or something, or what?
Actually, I didn't start writing until I think it must have been around 1964.
Okay.
My first writing that was published was I used to write a music column for Bill Blair's newspaper, which was called The Beacon. It later became, I guess, we called it The Eli.
Okay.
That started in 1964.
Okay.
And I've written music columns for a number of the, you know, black weekly and monthly newspapers.
Okay.
In fact, I was a news editor for the Dallas Express in 1965.
See, I didn't know that. Didn't know it. So you were the amusements. Wasn't that said again?
Amusements editor.
Amusements editor, and that was what publication?
Dallas Express.
For the Dallas Express, the oldest black-owned media in the Dallas area, goes back to the 1880s or something like that. So you were there amusing.
I don't know right that far. 1965. And my boss was Judy Scott Reed, and Eleanor Rolla was associated with the paper at that time, but my media boss.
Now, Julia Scott Reed was my mentor as a journalist, and my first knowledge of her, it was as a third grader sitting in the auditorium at H.S. Thompson Elementary School, and this black female came up on stage to speak, and I thought, I kind of already liked writing and reading in third grade, and I thought, what? There's a black woman who does what I like? And so that was my first introduction to, so you, she was your boss as the.
I learned a lot from her.
Oh, my gosh. Powerhouse woman. Yeah.
Right. And I went on to write for the Post Tribune. I had an article published in the Oakland Tribune. I wrote for two or three different papers that Jack Palms published.
Okay.
And a couple of others. Ross Stinson had a paper. I can't remember the name of it.
What? Who's that now? Who was that person?
Ross Stinson.
Oh, okay. But let me go. Let me put a pin in Jack Palms. I sure appreciate you mentioning that name, because when I was a student intern, and I interned at some of the black papers, and my memory wiped out his name. So when you said it just then, that brought back to me who he was. He was a character.
He really was.
He was a character. So thank you for bringing back the name of Jack Palms to me. But go on. You were talking about the other.
I learned a lot from him, too.
Tell me what you learned from Jack Palms.
Well, he just had a great philosophy and great love for music, too.
Oh, see, I didn't know that about him.
He used to take me to the Venetian Room, to all of the big shows. I got a chance to see Billy Eckstine and Betty Carter.
Yeah.
And just a whole bunch of the great performers that would come to the Venetian Room.
Okay. And
Jack had two tickets. You know,
okay. Help me remember where was the Venetian Room? It was okay. All right, very good. Okay.
Room there. I got to see Ahmad Jamal and just a whole bunch of people there. Joe Pass. And of course I was Jack's guest.
Uh-huh.
For those shows, because they gave him tickets, you know,
as a media person.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly.
Yeah.
Just a whole bunch of
wow. I bet you were in hog heaven, weren't you?
Oh, hey, that's great. And I remember one thing that I remember so much that, you know, Jack would say. I remember one thing that he told me that it stuck with me. He said, basically he's talking about how people might respond to him.
Yeah.
And he said that, you know, I won't know, but we won't know whether my life.
You want to say hi?
I do.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Say that again. He said what now?
Well, he just said that, he told me that the people who you most want to impress are people you went to high school with. You know, whatever you're attempt to achieve in life is to prove to your high school classmates, you know, that you were success. And ironically, well, I shouldn't say ironically, but that seems to be true.
Wait, now let me, okay, now wait, let me absorb that. I had never thought of that. Okay, now let me absorb it. So Jack Palm said that what we find as humans is that as we go through life, the people we really are trying to impress people we went to high school with. Why do you, and so you've thought about it, obviously. I haven't had time to really absorb it. So you've thought about it, and you kind of find that to be true?
Yeah, and then he concludes that by saying, only those who are allowed to attend my funeral will know whether or not my life ended in success or failure.
Wow.
This is Jack Palm all the way.
Oh, and, my gosh.
I find it to be true. My class just had a reunion like a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
They're still getting together for high school reunion.
Okay.
Our football heroes, for an example, in high school, our heroes. I mean, it's amazing how we just never grow beyond high school.
Wow. That's a deep thought. I just must confess I never thought of it that way, but I can't argue against that. I can't argue against it. And I guess why do we have reunions? You know, it's got to be some sort of message in that.
These are people that we most want to impress.
Wow.
I mean, this is Jack Farms all the way.
Yes.
I got that from him.
Right. When did he, roughly when did he leave us, by the way, and become an ancestor?
It's been, I don't know, I guess probably 20 years ago.
Okay.
Probably
yeah.
20 years ago. But anyway, I started writing for music columns for the local black newspapers.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote an article for one of the black newspapers that it was picked up by the Oakland Tribune.
Okay.
Reprinted in the Oakland Tribune.
Okay.
It was, I wrote about Johnny Shields, who was one of the first black salesmen
uh-huh.
at a company in downtown Dallas.
Okay.
At the music store, McCartney Music. And when he passed away, I wrote an article about him.
Okay.
Republished in the Oakland Tribune.
Okay.
And then, in 1973,
uh-huh.
I wrote my first music book, which was a self-teaching method book for bass guitar. And then I wrote a book for...
Well, let me stop right there. Let's stop right there. Okay, so you wrote your first music instruction book for bass guitar, did you say? Okay, now,
right.
Okay, here we go. You walking through your life. So one day, ding, 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 ding. You say, I think I'll write a music book. Well, how did you decide to do that?
Well, my interest in writing actually started when I was a senior at Bishop College.
Okay.
I had a wonderful, my all-time favorite teacher, Dr. Thelma Thompson Daniels.
Oh, I know that name.
And she was so encouraging. And she was the head of the music department in my last year.
Okay.
She encouraged, you know, everything that I tried to do as a writer.
Uh-huh.
And a music major for 4.5 years before I went to Bishop.
Oh.
I ended up going to Bishop 2 years after that, and I had to change my major to English because in the first 4.5 years that I attended in college as a music major, I didn't follow the catalog. I just took whatever music.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I never would have gotten a music degree.
Okay.
And when Bishop opened in 1961, I was just coming back from living in California.
Uh-huh.
And I attended Bishop College. And so I had to change my major to something.
Okay.
And at 15, I was accredited in music. And 15, I was accredited in history. So
yeah.
I and she encouraged me, you know, she let me write. I studied Shakespeare and all the great English writers and American writers. And I did a lot of reading and a lot of appreciating of these great writers.
Uh-huh.
And so once I got my degree at Bishop, I went to graduate school and majored in English at the University of North Texas.
Okay. Okay.
State University at the time. Still
isn't. I'm sorry. You majored in what at North Texas?
English.
I majored in English. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I had gotten a degree in English at Bishop with a minor in music, and so I actually had a double major because I ended up with more hours of credit in music than I had in English, but the degree was in English.
Wow. Wow.
So I went to graduate school as an English major.
Okay.
Okay. And before I could get my master's, I got drafted into the Army.
Ah!
I started in the Army, in the 9th Army Band in Fairbanks, Alaska. And after 3 months in the band, they transferred me to the Army Education Center, where I taught English for 18 months.
Oh, my gosh, you were just all over the place. I mean, look at that. Look at that background coming together to guide you on your journey. You're using the music part, you're using the English part. Wow. I'm blown away. Go ahead.
And so I came out of the Army, and you know, I worked in Dallas School District for a couple of years as a substitute.
Now, was that in the like around the 70s or something?
No, I came out of the Army in 1967.
67, okay.
So I served in the school district from 67 to 69. And then after that, I decided I was just going to be a full-time musician.
Okay.
But I continued to write, you know, for the newspapers and so forth.
But wait a minute. I'm going to jump in. I'm going to keep interrupting you. So when you made this decision that you were going to become a full-time musician, I'm assuming that your experiences back here, maybe in Dallas, I don't know how much traveling you were doing, something must have clicked that you really liked, that really ignited your passion. Because when people make life-changing decisions like that, I'm thinking that something happened. I mean, was something going on that was really clicking with you, or did you just want to try something new, or what?
Well, you know, the two things, the writing and the music, have always been parallel.
Okay, but okay.
At age 15, when I got my first guitar, having been influenced by B.B. King, Johnny Guitar Watson, people like that.
Okay.
I loved the guitar. I had been playing the ukulele for 5 years.
The ukulele, oh my gosh.
I started on ukulele at age 9. And it was close to my 10th birthday. And everybody, all the kids in the neighborhood had ukuleles. Arthur Godfrey was popular on television.
Okay.
All of us in the neighborhood wanted to play ukuleles. So
That's really something.
With the purchase of the ukulele, that came two free lessons.
Okay.
And so I took the two lessons and became a really good ukulele player.
Right.
The best of all of us in the hood.
Okay.
And so for my 15th birthday, my parents bought me a guitar, and I determined that I was going to really be good at it. So I worked on it, bought a lot of records. I bought every record that B.B. King and Johnny Guitar Watson put out, and learned every note on every record.
Oh, gosh.
Stuff to play by listening to the records.
Right.
And after 6 months, I was like 15 years old plus 6 months, I joined the Musicians Union.
What? Wait a minute. You joined the Musicians Union as a teenager?
At age 15 and a half, and started playing this gig.
Wow. Wait a minute. What did your parents and family say? I mean, did they support you in that, or thought, or you're kind of going off the edge here, or what?
Yeah, they supported me, particularly my mother. My dad wanted me to be a preacher or a lawyer.
Right. Did she play at all, or is she musical?
No, but I found out when she was 88 years old that she had a great voice and could sing.
Wow.
She never sang in church and never did any professional singing, but I discovered that it was, she was 88.
Now, you, wait a minute. You were one of how many siblings? You and how many siblings?
I have three brothers.
So there were four boys? There were four boys. Okay. Wow.
Anyway, she pretty much let me do anything that I wanted to do musically.
Okay.
But and she would let me go out of town and so forth with some of the older musicians, but she told me, don't let him drink, smoke, or use any drugs. It's all right for him to go. So I started traveling.
But wait a minute. Wait, did they adhere to her instruction?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right.
Plus, they were scared of her. You know, and they just respected me. The musicians in South Dallas, they were all musicians were based in South Dallas.
Okay.
They were very respectful, and they wanted me to play guitar in their groups, and so they did what she told them.
Okay.
I wasn't interested in that at that time.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's how my music career started. And then, of course, I went off to college when I was a senior at Madison High School. I was offered an exclusive contract with Jack Ruby.
Jack Ruby?
Yeah, I was playing. I was actually singing the blues at his club every Friday and Saturday night while I was singing in high school.
Okay, now wait, let me see if my memory, okay, now we know in history, Jack Ruby was the, like, club owner in Dallas,
right.
And he ended up killing the assassin of President John Kennedy.
Right.
And there you were working for...
A lot of us worked for Jack. Bob Stewart and I used to go and sing there on the weekend. Joe Johnson's band played. He was in the house, and the club was called the Vegas Club, and it was right where Pop Stewart is now on Oaklawn.
Is that right?
A couple of doors down from there.
Okay.
Near the intersection of Oaklawn and Lemon.
Okay.
So he offered me, he wanted to be my manager, and he wanted me to sign a 7-year contract with him as my exclusive manager. Now, that was in 1956.
Yeah.
If I had still been under contract to him when he killed Lee Harvey Oswald.
Wow. But now, let me tell me this. Okay, this whole contract discussion with entertainers, particularly our African-American entertainers, you have any – go ahead, I'll let you.
No, I don't.
Okay. Do you have any particular thoughts about, and I know I've even heard discussions about Prince and how he had some battles about owning his own rights and what have you, and he had all kind of protests, and finally he did get to own. What just in a few words, what are your thoughts? And like you just said, you obviously did not sign the contract for whatever reason. What are your thoughts about that and what we need to do to be diligent about not signing away our talents? What do you think?
Yes, do what I did. I took the contract to schools, and there was a man named John Rowland, who first taught commercial law at Madison High School.
Okay.
And you know, he knew about that sort of thing, and he looked at the contract and told me not to sign.
Okay. Wow.
So I think entertainers should get lawyers. It's just that simple.
Okay.
But before you sign these deals, you need to have a professional in that sort of thing, contract law and entertainment law, and have them to go over every clause. See, I believe that a contract is between two people. It's between the signer and the signee and the person who offers the contract.
Right.
And the talent. So
okay.
You need a lawyer. It's just that simple. You need to get a lawyer to look all of that stuff.
That's...
And don't find it. And today, let me just say this.
Go ahead.
Today with the internet, a lot of artists are signing themselves. In other words, music is not being sold the way it used to be sold. The only thing that a major label can do for you is to get your name out and get you the publicity.
Okay.
But, you know, a lot of these artists don't make money on royalties.
Okay.
And the money in the music business is in writing and publishing, not in singing and playing.
Okay, now let me ask you this, and you just opened so many brain cells in my head. Okay, now what you just said about this online stuff, I have heard, you know, Beyonce, that she kind of was out there with doing her own stuff online, and that she, and I don't understand all of it, but some kind of way she releases her own stuff and she gets to pocket a whole bunch more and all that kind of stuff. Am I on track with that or what?
Well, that's the artists today are much smarter. Of course, you know, her husband is a billionaire.
You're right.
The thing is, with the internet, you can launch your career. I can think of two stars now who started by putting stuff on the internet.
Okay. That Cowboys Country and Western young man. Did something like that, I think. I'm forgetting his name.
She's talking about Jimmy Allen.
I remember the name Jimmy Allen.
Yeah, he's a big black artist in country music now. But no, I was thinking of Issa Rae.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
She started her career online and was picked up. Those two black girls, can't think of that name.
Well, don't get me started.
And then Bieber.
Justin Bieber.
He started his career online.
Okay.
And a lot of artists have done that. They've been discovered on YouTube and places like that, and then picked up by the label. When they come to you, it becomes a seller's market. When you go to them, it's a buyer's market.
Okay.
So you can get them to come to you, then you can put your clauses in the
contract. Okay, now I got to jump in. Okay, now the information you're giving us now, it seems to me, and I'm just guessing, I understand that a lot of younger artists do seek you out, Mr. Roger Boykin from Dallas. By the way, you were born in Dallas, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, right. So I understand that a lot of up-and-coming artists do seek you out. You do some kind of consulting or something, don't you? Tell us about that. What, am I right? What?
I have occasionally, people call me and ask me about career stuff, but most of my consulting and mentoring was done through my teaching at Booker T.
Oh, okay. And do you keep in touch with a lot of those graduates, those students?
Oh, yeah. Mm. I do. Yeah. One of my former students will contact me almost every day.
Wow.
Some of them have become great artists. And one of the interesting stories.
Tell us.
One of the guitar players who was in the band at Book 2 that I conducted, which was the Rhythm and Blues Band.
Yeah.
Really good guitar player. And he continued to be a good guitar player, but when he went off to college, he majored in medicine, and he's now a doctor at Charleston Medical Hospital.
Get out.
He's still playing great guitar. So, you see, it's possible for a person to have parallel careers, like, I'm a writer and a musician.
Right.
A doctor and a guitar player.
Right. Oh, my God.
Dr. Carlos Velasco. And he's an ER doctor at Charleston Methodist Hospital.
His name is Velasco?
Carlos Velasco.
Oh, my gosh. That's what. Okay, now, I don't want to get away from, I want to get to your books. Okay.
All right.
Okay. Do you have copies that you could hold up of the book? Don't worry if you don't. Okay, let's start with your first book. Now I'm told that like one of your first one was A Date at the Opera. Is that it?
Well, that was my first novel. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm gonna let you just take us through these different books, because you've done a lot of publishing.
I sent you my latest.
Right, and I got that, and it's called Out of My Head.
Right.
Okay.
In fact, I'm thinking I'm just going to give that away.
Wait a minute. Why are you thinking that?
Well, because, for example, I was thinking if you buy one of my other books, I would just give you that one.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. I won't argue against that.
I think I might do it that way.
I won't argue against that. Great, great.
That one was done recently. In fact, A Day at the Opera was finished in December of 2015 and published in January of 2015.
Okay.
2016.
Okay.
And I didn't do any other writing like that until COVID.
Uh-huh, okay.
And because I wasn't getting off playing gigs.
Right.
Started writing books, and I actually also wrote 41 string quartets.
Wait. Say that again. You wrote 41 what?
String quartets. Performed 2 violins, viola, and cello.
And that's called twin quartets?
String quartets.
And you wrote 41 of them?
I wrote 41 short string quartets, and a couple of long ones, since COVID, because I've been at home just writing.
Right.
And 3 books as well. And the first literary work during COVID was one called Decades, which was a memoir.
Okay.
And it takes decades from the time that I was born up until 2020.
Okay.
From the period of 80 years. So
okay.
Each 10 years is a decade. So the first chapter is from 1940 to 1950. So that's the chapter 1950 to 1960, so forth.
You got to tell me. You did this in what period of time? What period of time did it take you to do that?
I think I did decades in about 3 months, 3 or 4 months.
Writing about how often a day?
Every day, every spare moment. While I was writing books, I kind of neglected the music because, first of all, I wasn't getting out playing.
Exactly. COVID, you couldn't get out anyway.
And my church was shut down. I had played for my church for 15 years.
What church is that?
Faithful Believers Baptist Church.
Believers Baptist Church. Is that in what part of town?
Faithful Believers Baptist Church. Well, in Eau Claire.
Okay, in Eau Claire. Okay.
We actually met at Bishop Dunn Catholic School in the auditorium.
Okay.
Congregation of about 75 people.
Okay.
And Walter Johnson was the pastor, and he was dean of students at Bishop Dunn, so we had church there on Sundays and prayer meeting on Tuesdays or Wednesdays.
Okay.
So the church rented the facility from the school.
Okay.
So a black Baptist church at a Catholic school. But I was a chief musician there for 15 years.
Okay.
Once it shut down, of course, I wasn't playing for the church, and I had, you know, a regular gig at a restaurant in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
Couldn't do that. And so I just started writing. I wrote the string quartets, and then I started writing the books.
Okay, wait a minute. Okay, now let me, because I want the audience to get this. Okay, we talked about Out of My Head. Now, that one you are considering just kind of giving as a gift along with if somebody buys one of your books. Okay, now then we have talk about Date at the Opera Date at the Opera, and that was around 2015 when you did that. Now tell us, what was that about?
It's about a couple that meets at the opera.
Mm-hmm.
In the Arts District. AT&T or Wyndham, one of them, I can't remember.
Right. Oh, and is it this is Dallas based? Dallas Page. Okay.
And these two people were both stood up by that date. And so they happened to be. And so the novel is about that relationship, how it developed. And it all takes place in Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Oh, my God. But, okay, now I got to ask you this. Because, well, I'll go ahead and ask it. But this question applies to all of your books. Now, okay, so you're sitting at home, not being able to get out. Ding, 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 ding. The idea comes up. I write about this couple. That means that, was it like that or was it not? How did you come up with that?
Well, Dr. Thompson at Bishop talking inspiration first, then craftsmanship. Inspiration, then craftsmanship.
Oh.
So if an idea came to me, I would write it down and do something with it and try to put it together. Then I would perfect it. That's where the craftsmanship came in.
Okay.
So I only try to write when the inspiration hits me.
Okay. So, but what inspired you about the opera? What inspired you about that?
Well, actually, a dream.
A dream. I love it. Go ahead.
I had a dream that two people met at the opera and that the woman had on a black dress. and then there was some other people there who were kind of loud, and anyway, these two people happened to get together at the opera, and it just went on and on from there.
Did it have a happy ending?
I can say yes. I don't want to.
Don't give it away.
No, but yes, it did have a happy
ending. Oh, too good. Okay. So we talked about decades where you took your life and did each decade up until 2020. I think, did you say you ended with 2020?
Right.
Okay, and then we talked about a date at the opera based in Dallas and with these two people who meet. They both got stood up and then they ended up together. Now, I want to talk about this one. Tales like a story. This book is called Tales. Now, y'all, let me kind of warn the audience. It's risque. It's body. It can be considered salacious. It could even be a little bit erotic. I mean, this man, he talks about escapades. And then tell us about, and you wrote this one. Well, you wrote that after decades.
Yeah, that was the fourth book.
Huh? That was the fourth one. Okay. Tell us about, huh?
It was the third one.
That was the third one. Okay. Tales.
Right. Now, how did that come about?
How in the world?
I tell you what inspired that one. Governor Cuomo of New York was getting in trouble for having tried to hit on some of his female
employees, underlings. Right.
And I felt like he was being mistreated.
Okay.
Because he just simply didn't have any rap.
Okay. Okay.
He didn't know how to talk to women. And so he was, I don't know, past 60 years old. He was a divorcee. And he was just doing the best he could as a divorced man who wanted some female attention.
Okay.
So this idea came to me in defense of him, really.
Okay.
So I set up this fictitious situation because I was trying to show women can be just as aggressive as men, but don't get in trouble for it.
Okay.
So if you look at that book, you will see that there were almost every situation involving my male hero.
Uh-huh.
Involved women being aggressive towards him, women initiating the relationship.
Wow. And I think you used the language in explaining the book that the man can be both the hunter And go ahead.
And the prey.
Can be both the hunter and the prey. Oh, my gosh. Now, that is a provocative thought. That's a, now, I don't know if my sister girlfriends are going to agree, but I can't argue against what you're saying, that a lot of women are just as aggressive as we are taught to consider the man being. I can't argue against it. I'm sure someone in the audience out there might disagree. But yeah. So you based this article. Go on. Go ahead.
And one of the escapades in that came from something that actually happened. That was used to be a club in Oakland called Studio 67.
Oh, I know about that studio. Studio 67.
And one of my neighbors in the apartment where I lived at the time went there one night. He was an athletic type guy, you know, and I guess the woman found him attractive. He was just minding his own business in there. And went up to the bar to, you know, have a drink or whatever. And a woman passed by him and grabbed his butt.
What?
This actually happened. And so I used that idea as for one of the essays because it actually happened to this guy.
Oh, my God.
And he turned around and he I think he told her, you know, if I had done this to you, I would be arrested.
Absolutely true. Did they get together, though? Did they get together?
No, they
did not. They did not.
Because he was interested. He was single and he was interested. And so I used that as the several incidents that actually happened.
Oh, my gosh.
To people, but, you know, my fictitious character.
Right.
Goes through all these escapades with these women who hit on him for different reasons.
Oh, my goodness, my goodness.
And so I was just trying to show that women can be
aggressive. Now, I want to know, did you get much pushback from readers about the premise of the book, or what did you notice as being the public reaction for the book? And again, I must say, it is kind of bawdy and risque and erotic and all that kind of stuff. What kind of pushback or reaction did you get?
Well, my female friends who have read it generally liked it and were not offended by anything there because they understood. And of course, these are all women over 50 years old.
Okay, okay.
And so they had experience.
Okay, okay.
I don't know what a young woman would think about it. Probably wouldn't agree with that.
Maybe, because we don't know. Yeah.
Because the conventional wisdom now is that men are aggressive and ought to be put in jail or fired or whatever. But, you know, as they get older and become cougars, well, I shouldn't say that.
But they do become, we become cougars.
I don't see anything wrong. In fact, I think the best relationships, certainly the best ones that I've had, were the result of the women approaching me.
Wow, now that's a thought. That
I'll
is...
tell you why I believe that.
Why?
Because I don't think a man can convince a woman of anything.
Huh.
A woman can make up her own mind.
Well, now I'm gonna give you pushback on that, because I think now, certainly there is a large percentage of women who have their own mind, but I'm convinced that there still are a lot of impressionable, and I don't know whether they're young, old, or maybe all ages, females who can be controlled and improperly taken advantage of.
Yeah, well, that's true, and because a lot of, I call them homeboys, a lot of the pickings are rough for young women these days.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a whole lot of guys that, you know.
Take advantage. But I love the you putting that out there, that what I heard you say was that you believe women really can't be convinced. Say it again.
In terms of relationships. I don't think a man can convince a woman of anything. She either likes him or she doesn't.
Absolutely.
And he can buy her drinks, take her out to dinner, do this, wine, and that, whatever. But if she doesn't really like him, she might take the free dinner, and it won't go as a woman makes the relationships. I have found that the longest-lasting marriages are the marriages where men let their wives have their way.
Okay.
And don't challenge their wives.
Okay.
And I think the thing that makes a woman beautiful is a woman, happiness is what makes a woman beautiful.
Okay.
If a woman happy, she's beautiful.
Okay.
A happy woman will give you her best.
And I think I've heard saying something like, and I'm going to misquote it, but it's along the lines of what you're saying. A happy woman is a happy family, something like that.
Oh,
if the woman, yeah, you know,
oh,
if the woman, yeah,
sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's it. And so I just believe that, and I think the best relationships are the ones initiated by the woman.
Now let me quickly change, because we're getting, believe it or not, oh my gosh, I've been enjoying talking to you so much. But we're getting close to our tuning out time. But I did want the audience to be blessed with some of your musical talent, if you would be so kind. I don't know if you're near a keyboard or a piano. Kind of give us a little rendition.
This is one of my books.
Oh, what? Now, what is that? Which one is that? Okay.
Keyboard Harmony from the Basics. I actually wrote this as a textbook for my class at Booker T, because I was teaching a class called Functional Piano, and it didn't have a textbook.
Okay.
And so I wrote one.
Okay. Okay.
For my class.
Okay. Okay.
Now, I'm at the piano.
Okay.
Original song of mine,
okay.
Which is based on a lot of old sayings.
Okay.
And I string them together into a blues song.
Okay.
I sing, so you have to forgive my
sound. No, go ahead.
I don't brag on myself.
If you don't fit, baby, don't force it. If the mill spills, baby, don't cry. You get strap wings on a monkey, but you know you can't make them fly. No, you got to roll with the punches. Everything will be all right. Life ain't nothing but a party, big fun on a Saturday night.
Oh my goodness! Oh, I love it! Love it! I love it! That's gonna take me through. That's gonna take me through the day.
Yeah.
Okay, I gotta ask you. I gotta ask you about that. Oh, and one of our chat people says Roger the Great Barkin.
Okay.
Yeah, we know about it. So, but now when you play at a gig.
Mm-hmm.
You're at the keyboard. Now, who's with you, and how did you assemble your group? It's called the Roger Barkin Trio or something like that, isn't it? Or what?
Well, for years I was with the trio. I still do sometimes, but 90% of my gigs over the past, 10 or 15 years,
uh-huh.
have been just solo piano.
Is that? See, I didn't know. I didn't know.
Most of the work for a professional piano player is solo. Playing by myself at church.
Yeah.
The restaurant where I worked at, it was just me and a piano. And so there are a lot of occasions where you just, you know, play by yourself. But when I have to assemble a group, then I do. And I also play with Herbie Johnson.
Oh, yeah. Okay, there's a name, Herbie Johnson.
And we play a couple of gigs a month, and I've only been playing with him since COVID.
Okay.
And he gets gigs through the city of Dallas.
Okay.
The repair department.
Okay.
In the daytime, we play for a lot of senior citizens. We play at recreation centers and churches.
Okay, now let me jump in because we're about to wind up. I want the public to know, piggybacking on what you're just saying, how can they get in touch with you to either line you up to come and perform, and also how can they, these books, one is Decades, that's the memoir, one is A Date at the Opera, that's about the couple meeting, one is Tales,
okay.
Go ahead. How do we get this stuff?
Is available from Amazon.
Okay. Let me get that. Okay. To get a copy of Telltales, go on Amazon. Okay. Now,
And you can order it through Amazon.
Okay. You can order Telltales through Amazon. And then let me just go ahead to Out of My Head. That one, they contact you, I guess. Did they contact you?
Yes, through my website, Roger Barkin Music.
Okay, and we're going to put your website, let me see, your website and your email and I think a phone number. We're going to put that in the chat. It may already be in the chat. But your website, your email, and your iCloud email, that will be in the iCloud email. And then I think some kind of phone number I think we have.
All right, and the other two books, A Date at the Opera and Decades, are only available through Apple.
Okay, Apple. Now, how does, and help me out on this.
They're just digital books.
Okay, digital. Okay.
Yeah, but Telltales is actually a paperback.
Okay, but now, wait a minute. So Decades is digital, and A Date at the Opera is digital?
Okay. Those are both ebooks. And you have to have Apple device in order to purchase. Apple computer.
Let me get that. You have to have an Apple computer or know somebody who has one.
On iPad or an iPhone.
Okay.
Sales is available through Amazon.
Okay.
And Out of My Head, I just have to order that.
On your website, okay.
From my email.
Okay. Website or email.
That's digital also.
Oh, it's digital also. Okay, very good.
And my music books are all digital.
And all of those books are mentioned on my website, rodneywashington.com. List all of my books and records.
Okay. Now, as to wrap up, what's ahead for your future? I know you are available, like I said, for different gigs. Is there a book, another book stuck in the back of your brain? What's up for the future?
But I'm a little reluctant to write it. Let me just say that right now I'm really troubled by the fact that we are the divided states of America, not the United States of America.
Don't get me started. Don't get me started.
In my books, the afterthoughts in Telltales and Decades speak about the political climate of America right now.
Okay.
And so, all of my books have a message.
Okay.
They may seem trivial or light in terms of most of the content, but there's always some messages in there. And
okay.
So I got a political book kind of in my head. I haven't really gotten the inspiration to get started on it, and I'm presently working on a piece for string orchestra.
Okay. Oh, and I did want to tell the audience that one year, I think it was in the late 90s or something like that, the Dallas Symphony Orchestra performed one of your pieces or your compositions. So tell us about that before
we... The offices of the Black Academy of Arts and Letters.
Okay.
That Symphony in Black. Curtis King arranged all of that.
Okay.
I also wrote a play called Zanzibar that was performed at the Black Academy.
See, we didn't even list that, because that was, I remember hearing about that this play was Zanzibar, and
right.
And it was performed at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters, and that was roughly, when was that?
1990.
It was that night. Okay, great. Were you pretty pleased with how that went, or what?
Yeah, but the Times Herald fanned it. They didn't like the dialogue. They loved the music. And then they went out of business. Put the Times Herald out of business. No, but
is that called equal justice?
I didn't know. But I'm trying to revise it. I want to update it and do it again, because there's a lot of good music in that show.
Oh, great. Well, anytime the name Roger Boykin is linked with any music, it's going to be great music. Okay. And which brings me to a question I forgot. Do you ever destroy your work, just like throw it away, to rip it up and say, I don't like that? Do you ever do that or what?
What I have done, I just put it in the piano bench or whatever and just leave it. And sometimes years go by and I'll reach.
Oh, great. I like to hear that.
As I become older and wiser and more skilled, I can look at some of the past stuff with a more critical eye.
Yeah, right. It just wasn't ready when it first came to you. And I understand that I might maybe misquoting her, but I think the late author Toni Morrison, I think, used to do something like that, unless I'm mixing her up with somebody. But, yeah, I can see that. The timing just isn't there.
Well, you know, I said inspiration and then craftsmanship. And sometimes the craftsmanship takes years.
Exactly. Now, before we wrap up, I think we've got about 4 or 5 minutes. Any other points that are just on your heart? You mentioned about your thoughts about the political situation, but any other points that we've not covered that you want to bring up?
I never miss an opportunity to vote.
Oh, wow.
I vote whenever there's something to vote for, I go and vote. And I think we have to do that in spite of the times that we live in and the way things are looking. I think we just have to be optimistic and remember that there's a Swahili expression, Shalabongo, is all up to God.
Any thoughts on there's been a dying away, as you well are aware, of voting and the importance of it, particularly with the generation that is before us now. Any way or thoughts that you have on how to get them out there? Because, like, as you said, particularly now with this climate that we're in, any thoughts on what?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I think should happen.
Mm-hmm.
In order to combat some of the negative stuff that's out there.
Yeah.
MAGA, for example. Make America Brave, we ought to change it to MAGAL, Make America Great at Last, because as far as I'm concerned, America has never been great for black people except those 10 or 11 years during Reconstruction.
Now, you know, Michelle Obama kind of got in trouble for expressing that exact opinion. She kind of got in trouble. And you know what, we're coming up to the 4th of July, and I was never taught that we had not, it just didn't occur to me. We were still enslaved. Why should we celebrate 4th of July?
I celebrated the 4th of July. I didn't celebrate Independence Day. We just didn't call it that. But once I read Frederick Douglass.
Yes, yes, yes.
That was the 5th of July speech or whatever.
Right.
I was convinced that we should celebrate Juneteenth as black people.
Okay, okay. I concur.
Thanks to Oprah Lee, it happened. So.
Well, go ahead.
I don't celebrate the 4th of July.
Well, I was a very late comer. But anyway, will you take us out? We've got 90 seconds left. Will you take us out? And then an audience, I know y'all are just uplifted with this wonderful visit we've had with magic musician Roger Boykin. He's going to play us out in this last 90 seconds. Cotton is high. My dad is rich. Mom is good looking. Hush, little baby. Don't. You cry. Thank you, Roger Boykin. Go forward and conquer. We love it. Bye-bye, everybody. Summertime. All right, we're tuning out. Thank you.